Coming up today, giving AI SaaS, Matt Burgess's robot buddies, and we debate the benefits of app-based contraceptives. You're listening to episode 304 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Williston.
Hello.
Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
Matt nearly fell over, leaning in to say hello.
Diving for the microphone.
Yes, diving. Roland and Matt have to share because we only have three microphones. We should also say that we are Maroon 3 this week. Vicky noticed that Matt, Roland and I are all wearing very similar shades of maroon.
And also editor Greg Williams is as well, but he's not on the podcast.
So we're nearly Maroon 5.
Nearly Maroon 5.
We're getting there. What did you learn this week, Vicky?
I love tunnels. I didn't learn that this week, but I do love tunnels and I really love trains. So the thing I learned this week, that Eurostar has been refurbishing all of its E300 trains. They actually re-entered the fleet today. Roland,
you can't dust yourself.
That noise was Roland rubbing his stomach.
Carry on, Vicky.
I zoned out and started dusting myself, as you do.
Back to trains.
Yes.
What
is it about trains that just makes you zone out and start dusting yourself? I don't know.
So each of the new trains in the fleet have 30,000 new parts, 2,800 are completely repainted, 2,086 are new lights, 1,800 are completely overhauled, they have 100 new digital screens and 22 bogies.
Which is wheels stuff.
It's a structure that takes the wheels, yeah.
So these are the trains that were introduced when the Eurostar first started.
Yeah, they refurbished the old ones. So they've got their new fleet.
Yep.
They've also given some love to their older ones.
See, I
like
the old ones. They had big comfy seats.
Well, they've got even bigger comfy seats. This and all the pictures are on wired.co.uk.
Good plug for the site you worked for. Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
I learned that a duck called Big Dave was sold for £1,500 in 2012 and he's the most expensive duck ever sold at auction.
What
is
going on?
Excellent. Well done, Big Dave. £15,000.
£1,500, sorry.
£1,500. Okay. Well, that's more. Yeah. Of course a duck costs that much. Roland?
I learned that Amazon is building a giant warehouse Zeppelin that it's going to fly drones up to do deliveries from. Well, sort of building. They've got a patent for it.
But, yeah, are they really? Are they really?
But then it's a bit like, you know, a while ago they had that patent for that store where no one would pay. You just walk in and take stuff and then you'd leave. Mm. And then they did it. So it could happen.
True to their word.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. That's Amazon for you. Ruthless execution, even on mad ideas.
I learned that Asian and non-Asian ears produce different types of earwax. So a small... Yes? What?
What's
you were leaning in.
What's different about them?
Well, a small change in the ABCC11 gene, which is also related to reduced underarm body odor found in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean people, also means that Caucasian earwax smells more. It has a greater amount of odorous compounds.
Nice.
So we have smelly earwax. There you go. Matt Burgess. No, Roland Manthorpe, your story number one. Google Assistant, there's a fascinating little profile of a sort of hidden star of one of Google's major, major pieces of technology in this issue of Wired. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so I wrote about Emma Coates, who works on the team who writing the dialogue for Google Assistant, which is this kind of chatty digital helper that Google is putting into all its products from its chat app Allo to its kind of Amazon Alexa, copy, basically, Google Home. And so she basically writes those little kind of interesting bits of chat so that when you say something like, tell me the way to the moon, it's able to say, I don't know the way to the moon. Are you sure you want to go there? That kind of thing.
Wouldn't that be dangerous? And it's like, ha ha ha, what a witty AI.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's basically to give it personality, which is really interesting because these things are meant to be AIs, but actually their personality is written by people.
Funnier and she's got than Burgess.
Funnier than Burgess. No pressure to be funny, Matt Burgess. And Emma comes from an interesting background. She's from Pixar.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So she used to work at Pixar. And she worked on Brave and Inside Out. And she's actually became quite famous briefly on the internet for a while because she did this thing called Pixar's 22 Rules of Storytelling, basically codifying the Pixar way into a whole bunch of rules.
Which sounds very grand, but it originally started off, I think she just put stuff on Twitter, right?
Exactly. So she started tweeting out the kind of Pixar essentials, things like I think rule number one is you admire a character for trying more than for their successes. Things like that. So it was really interesting to talk to her about how these rules and this kind of storytelling method influence what she's doing with the Google AI.
Well, one of the things I really liked about it in your profile where she says, do you know what? You can't just write a nice character because nice is pretty boring. You have to have something about them. It doesn't mean they have to be horrible or evil, but there needs to be something about them, which is what she's trying to do with Assistant.
Well, it's interesting because so with the Assistant, it can't have too much of a character. So she said, you know, if I gave it a dark inner secret of sort of some sort of conflict that it was struggling to get over, then it wouldn't necessarily be that helpful as an assistant. So so she talked about how the assistant is more like a chirpy sidekick. Someone, you know, because it's always enthusiastic. It's always into the things that you're into. It's sort of got a personality, but it sort of doesn't.
There's a veneer to it. So I think rule 13 of her 22 rules for storytelling at Pixar was give your characters opinions. Passive, malleable might seem likable to you as you write, but it's poison to the audience. But this is different in giving an AI personality because it needs to be quite neutral.
Yeah, exactly. So after she left Pixar, Emma worked on a game called Demi Lovato Path to Fame.
Oh, yeah, play it all the time.
Yeah, well, I hear it's great. I hear it's excellent. So she kind of did the script for that. And she actually said that as much as her work at Pixar, this was really influential. So basically in the game, Demi takes you, the main character, under her wing and you rise to fame recording songs and basically making Demi proud. And what she learned from this is that in that you need an endearing sidekick. You know, someone who, yeah, is always open to your ideas, never cuts you down and basically has a bunch of really witty quips. It's essentially all about the witty quips.
And something else it's kind of the unexpectedness of it. So it's a very small team that she works on that's also part of the same team or sits near the team that does Google Doodles.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of weird creative arm of this massive technology company that's an awful lot to do with code and servers and processing power. But in order for this AI to work to begin with, it needs the help of humans. It needs that creative touch.
Yes, until one day it learns how to do it itself and then it will replace those humans.
So this is the underlying irony in the story and of profiling this really, really interesting person is that she's, maybe like a lot of us, working to put herself out of a job.
Yes. And weirdly, she seemed totally fine about that. She was like, yeah, it's really interesting. It's really cool. And one day it'll replace me and then I'll go do something else.
So how does that actually work in practice? It's at the moment, it needs help from humans in order to be relatable and you can interact with it in a friendly way. So you're more likely to give it more information. And then once it learns how we talk, it doesn't need the human input to help it in that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess once the data set is big enough and it's able to interpret it correctly, then it should be able to come up with its own responses. But I think also in a way what you're doing at the beginning is you're setting the parameters of the personality. You're defining what this is like. Then once you set those parameters and you've determined what the sort of thing that this identity would say, then it can go ahead and come up with similar things. But being funny is hard. I mean, as Burgess knows. So so it might be a while until an AI is actually able to come up with just the sort of right quips that fit within the Google brand. Because this is a lot of what it's about, really, is, you know, like, what sort of jokes would Google make? It can't be too off-colour or
like Microsoft's Taybot.
Yeah, exactly.
Went massively off the rails and went racist. I mean, that's the extreme.
Poor Tay.
So yeah. It's a super interesting project. You can read the profile in the latest issue of Wired, which is out now, and it will also be online in a few weeks.
It's currently online right now.
It's online right now.
Yes, it is.
There you go. There's no need to buy the magazine. Please buy the magazine.
Please do. Please
Second
do.
Story, robots. Matt Burgess, earlier this week, you went to hang out with a load of robots at the Science Museum. We're all very jealous because there's lots of them and they're very different.
Eric is my homeboy. I love Eric.
So Eric is one of the robots, which is part of the new exhibition at the Science Museum, the great British institution that it is. And it's running a exhibition until September, that's basically chronicling the history of robots and how they reflect humans. And we actually have Ben Russell, who is the curator of the exhibition, on the podcast now. And I asked him sort of a lot of questions about how this has come to be.
Yeah, how it's developed over time and how they got all the robots in. They're from all over the world, lots of different sources. And you started off by asking him about the oldest robot in the collection.
The oldest robot we've got in the show is a mechanical, it's an automaton monk. which we've loaned from the National Museum of American History, the Smithsonian in Washington. It's about 1560, approximately. And it's a formidable-looking 15-inch high guy. He would pursue a rectangular course on a tabletop. He would hold a rosary and a crucifix. There's lovely detail to the face, moving eyes, moving mouth. When he sees feet moving as well, he walks, so he pursues his course, and he prays for you, which one historian described as the early modern mechanization of faith. And you think, oh, wow. and so that was one of the sort of starting points for the exhibition. There's a lovely, rich, fruity cultural history of robots, which isn't just a modern expo of all the latest modern stuff, but which takes our sort of 500-year obsession with rebuilding our machines. And you start off with things like the Monk.
Yeah, and one of the things that really struck me was also the Silver Swan, which is, I'll let you describe it, but basically it is the name is there.
It's a massive piece of bling, isn't it? So the Silver Swan was built in 1773. It's a life-sized swan made of silver. It was built by a chap called John Joseph Merlin, who was a mechanician based in London. And it was first displayed at a place called Cox's Mechanical Museum. London is the centre for anyone who has something they want to show, they show it in London. And so the swan was a lovely piece of mechanism. It would preen itself. It would look around. It would reach down and catch a fish, pick it up, appear to swallow it. Actually, there's a bit of artifice going on there. And then it would return to its starting position. It performs. What they say is that we're going to play the swan. And so as it's going through this lovely, sort of incredibly dexterous set of actions, so there's music which accompanies it. So it was an absolutely a piece of spectacle, really.
And that's what, in my impression, a lot of these robots, as they're called, were built originally, so the ones that are a couple of hundred years old. So for people that are listening, in terms of how they work as robotics, they're not like what we consider them to be now?
No. And there's so many definitions of a robot which you could have. I think we got up to about 40. Pretty much everyone who's had to do a research project has said, we think a robot is X or Y. We said a robot is a machine that looks lifelike or it behaves in lifelike ways, and we tended to concentrate on the humanoid. The human form as mechanism, but I think the behaves in a lifelike way is important, because sometimes you get objects which aren't humanoid, and we still tend to imbue them with lifelike properties. It's our natural human instinct to anthropomorphize, and really that's what the show is about. We it's using mechanism as a medium to say, well, actually, you know, what are we as human beings, and how do we reinvent that?
And that's your best definition of a robot. What was the most out there definition of a robot that you really came across?
Well, actually, one of the more controversial ones was a chap who said a robot is any machine that puts someone out of a job. Full stop, bleak, stare into the future. There's lots of different ones. We tried to... The knack of having a definition for an exhibition is you want something that allows you to filter out the stuff that doesn't quite fit, but at the same time gives you a little bit of latitude for manoeuvre. You don't want to constrict yourself too tightly. And it's a cultural definition, because basically what we're saying in the show is, you know, science is culture. It's not that separate weird thing that exists in its own right. It's created by people for people, and why would we not think of it that way? So as a definition, it's worked pretty well. I hope that's reflected in the way the show's worked out.
And one of the things that I got from walking around for the exhibition, which is over a few different rooms, is that there's really this progression that you get from the robots that were hundreds of years old to that the newest ones, the most modern things that we see in the market now. So is that something that really reflects across there? And are there similarities really between these bots that were hundreds of years old and the brand new ones?
I think... It's an interesting question. I think people interact with them in different ways. So if you've got an automaton monk, your interaction with the thing is very much the sort of psychological interaction of, oh, wow. But of course, coming from a time before most people had clocks, suddenly you've got a tiny miniature figure which actually has a magical quality to it. So actually it speaks to people's sense of devotion, their religious devotion, that sort of thing. A modern robot... I think the interaction is slightly different. The magical quality is still there. Arthur C. Clarke says any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And that's interesting. That's our modern thing, and that starts way back in the early modern period. But I think perhaps when we look at it, we think probably more sort of, oh wow, what an amazing bit of technology. And I wonder how it links into the cloud or all that sort of stuff. So our fascination with it is slightly different, perhaps a bit more sort of technologically curious, as opposed to this is a wonder of God's creation.
And as you get from that sort of initial stage of the monk, of the swan, of the articulated hands and small parts of robotics, you go through the cycle where humans robots become more like humans. And I think one of the key stages in this is Eric, which was rebuilt by the Science Museum last year, and we've talked about on the podcast before, where you've just got these steel, I guess, aluminium
looking.
They're
big sort of broad-shouldered, very overtly masculine tin men, aren't they? And it's interesting because then you start to get into issues of gender around robotics. Actually, the first blockbuster robot was Maria in Fritz Lang's Metropolis, and she's very, very female. And then as you come up to now and looking a little bit into the future, gender becomes a hotly debated thing. And so we had quite a big discussion about, do we call it he or she or it? Roboticists tend to say it's it, but you can't help innately assigning gender to robots. Which is interesting. One of them is Pepper, which was built by SoftBank, which is a remarkable piece of technology. And I instinctively thought it was a she. And actually, I must confess that I thought, oh, hello. But then you think, hey, goodness me, it's a robot. But then you realise that SoftBank say, well, actually, it's a he. And so you just sort of come out of these things a bit confused and perhaps slightly messed up and not knowing quite what to think anymore. I don't know. But historically, actually, if you go back to the early period, robots very often did tend to be women or childlike, and their audience was primarily men. And then it's interesting to see how that evolves over time.
And do you think that we're going to keep seeing ourselves in robots and reflecting ourselves? Because lots of the modern ones that are coming out now are humanoids and very humanistic in their movements and also just appearance.
I think we will continue to see them. It's what we do. We anthropomorphize. It's probably the sole uniquely human trait that we have left. And as actually, one of the ploys we have with the show is, if you go to the V&A or any art museum, it's full of anthropomorphism because we tend to have objects which are given human form. There's portraits, portrait busts, sculpture of humans, that sort of thing. And actually sort of us sticking our oar in and say, well, don't forget us technologists and historians of technology are actually saying, well, actually mechanism is as much a valid medium for interpreting that as anything else. But yes, looking ahead, we still anthropomorphize. We're fascinated by humanoids. And I think it's interesting because they are very much reflections of technological capability. That, Honda were a car manufacturer, and then when they started to work on the Asimo series of robots, it's weird that rather than building a robotic car, they went humanoid on us. So it's one of those things you do to represent your capabilities, what a company can do in terms of making astonishing mechanisms. You just instinctively go for a human-shaped thing. It's curious, isn't it?
And do you think you actually learned anything yourself and what this reflects about us as a society?
It's funny. The main learning point for me was that actually we're not rational beings, I suppose anyway you could tell that from the way the world has gone recently. But if you talk to scientists and engineers, they have a very particular view of the world, which is very, 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 you do that, then you do that, then you do that, and this is the reason we're doing it. And in a way, that's very much a question of, well, how you do something. But actually, what we've done in this exhibition is say, well, why do we do this? And as soon as you say why, it's a much more tricky, more convoluted question, because it brings in issues of actually what is your human human motivation to innovate or create an object. And that's a whole world of complexity, which isn't just about how you make it, but in terms of your motivations might be, actually, we just like a show, we're interested in spectacle, we like things which have a magical quality which we can't quite explain. They might be uncanny, the robots are liminal things, they're not quite alive, they're not quite dead, they're not quite man, they're not quite machine, and it evolves a whole range of emotional responses which are in a way are generating why we build the machines. Now, it's interesting because, in a way, if you put that in opposition to how the formal scientific way of doing it, you start to raise questions of actually, well, are scientists and engineers in doing what they do actually contradicting their own humanity and refusing to accept that they're human and their motivations might be anything other than purely rational? It's weird.
It is, and I think it does reflect society at the moment. And in
and that's the point in the show. He said after about 10 minutes of finally getting to the point, actually, we're using these robots as mirrors on the world in which they were created. So actually, in the 15th century, you have a tremendously devout society. Of course you'd build automata of crucifixions or Satans screaming at you from pulpits or mechanical monks. The 19th century is about factories and mills and workshops and division of labour and arkwright and what and all that stuff. So actually, you tend to build cybernetic machines like cotton spinning mules, and the people are reduced to the role of automatons in that machine. So robots you create reflect directly the world that they develop in. They are effectively propositions about the state of the world at the time. Now, the intriguing question is, what do the robots we're creating now say about us? Which I prefer to leave as an open question, really, rather than trying to give you a definitive answer.
And out of all the things you put together, have you got a favourite? Is there something that is you're really proud to have in the collection?
My favourite thing, actually, is it didn't take a human form, but it had aspects of human behaviour to it. It's an automaton lathe, which we rebuilt. It was a 400-odd piece jigsaw puzzle, which we'd never displayed, or not in its entirety, and had never really been sort of satisfactorily pieced together. It's the most astonishing piece of decoration. I've joked with people. It's an amazing 2.5 meters of pure bling. But that's what it is. It's a most remarkable wrought iron frame with this amazing Rococo decoration on it. And really, it comes from a genre of automatons, which are, you know, the classic 18th century thing. They draw, they play musical instruments. And this one would replicate the work of a human turner working with a lathe. Entirely, you know, using an automaton mechanism. So you set it running and you step back and it just does it. But it produces a very small... about the size of a draft piece with a lovely pattern engraved onto it. And so this, you know, if you were an aristocrat or a nobleman, you'd have a cabinet of wonders and you'd have this amazing machine in the middle of it. And you would say, look at me, aren't I the thing? I have a machine which can replicate life. And aren't I brilliant? And can I annex your kingdom or whatever it was? You're showing the thing too. So it's an intriguing thing. It was sold as having been Frederick the Great's. And in a way, this is the changing balance in the world. You've gone from the church-building automatons to aristocrats and noblemen who have money to spend and have realised the imaginative potential of machines that are lifelike.
Yeah, well, some fascinating stuff. I'd encourage people to go down and look at the exhibition at the Science Museum. There are hundreds of year-old robots to the latest technology embedded with artificial intelligence that's lifelike, moving. You can interact with things, and the exhibition is open now from February until September. And I think it's touring around the world and the UK afterwards.
Yeah, so it shuts, I think, on the September 3rd in the museum. Then we go to three other venues in the UK, and then we go off touring internationally as well. So if 50 years' time we look back in from our bunkers with our tinned food and our scarce water supplies and think, crikey, where did the robot apocalypse started? Perhaps it started in the museum. I hope I'm not around to see that.
Well, we'll wait. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you spent a whole morning hanging out with all those robots, and thanks to Ben for coming on the podcast. Matt Burgess, what was your favourite robot out of all the ones you saw?
Well, like Vicky, my favourite has to be Eric, the oldest British robot, which was a humanoid and was recreated after a Kickstarter campaign last year.
And we've been following Eric for years.
Yeah, it was good to see him in the flesh, well, the metal, not the flesh.
Yeah, see his metal. Okay, so thank you. Our third story is a bit of a complicated one, and it's sort of split into two parts. The first part, Roland, Natural Cycles is the first app contraceptive to be approved for use on the NHS, correct?
Yes.
And this is a big story.
Well, actually, not quite.
Not quite. Go on, fill us in.
Well, So basically, Natural Cycles is an app which algorithmically monitors female fertility, and it has been officially approved for use as a contraception. So it could now be prescribed on the NHS. It's not quite there right yet, but okay. It has been approved by this German testing organisation, which I'm now going to pronounce as TÜV SÜD.
Good enough.
Vicky? Is that about right?
That's about right.
Okay. No is a no. Anyway, this is one of the certification bodies that are employed by the Department of Health to test the safety of new drugs. And they have approved this. They have basically said that you can use this app as a contraception and it's as good as the pill.
So it's 99.5% as accurate as the pill, which doesn't mean it's as effective as the pill, but it means that it's as accurate as the pill.
Well, no, so actually, because the pill isn't a perfect method of contraception, and so Natural Cycles, according to studies, and this, I mean, when you go into the studies, I think more work needs to be done. It is as effective as the pill. It actually is. It's quite complicated. It has an efficacy rating of 99.5%.
Okay.
Which is not the same as being 99.5% effective.
Right.
Yes, I know.
For scientific reasons.
for crucial science. Basically, it's just like they give these things a score called on this thing called the Pearl Index, which is basically like how well does this contraception work? So if like not having sex at all or never even going near another person is a 10, this is a 7. Vic just pointed at Burgess.
Rude.
But this is a major step. Sorry, Burgess. I mean, this is significant. So I know that it's say there's all these caveats around the studies and the efficacy and the efficiency and all that sort of stuff. But actually, this is significant because there are loads of apps out there that claim to help you monitor your fertility or monitor your periods or things like that. But this has actually been approved, and that's what has caught the interest this week, I think.
Yeah, and the background of the people who did it is really incredible. So it's done by this woman, Alina Berglund. So she used to work at CERN, and she actually was one of the kind of part of the team working on the Large Hadron Collider that discovered the Higgs boson. But while she was there, she was having some kind of problems using the pills. She wasn't really happy with her method of contraception. And so she started developing this algorithm using advanced statistical methods that she'd learned during her career as a particle physicist. To basically, and what you do is you kind of if you're using it and you're a woman, you test your body temperature every day, and it uses the slight variations in body temperature created by different hormones to see whether you are in a fertile period or not. And then it can get on the app. Basically, there are kind of green and red days. Green day, it's okay to have unprotected sex. Red day, you need to use another method of contraception.
So do you take your temperature separately, or your phone can do that for you as well?
Yeah. So you have to take your temperature separately. Mm. And this is why it's not really recommended for people who really don't want to get pregnant, because I think that
there's a bit of legwork involved.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So it's not recommended for people who say, like, especially young people.
Right. And this is the interesting thing for mm-hmm. me, is that it's kind of being marketed at people in long-term stable relationships, they're a little bit older. It's not a good idea for teenagers to be using this because they're probably in less stable long-term relationships, right? That's the idea.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I think there's been some people on Twitter have commented, especially women have gone, there is no way, 100% I would never use this. And that's the point of it, is that you can't just give it a go. Let's just give the app a try and see what happens, because if you do not want to have a baby, then you are running that's a huge, huge risk. What I will say, though, is that I know friends of mine who have got pregnant when they're on the pill. Like what you're saying, it's not a perfect method. It's just because it's been through so many decades now of research and development and things, people are now at a point where they go, actually, I trust it. Mm. This app could eventually, or mobile devices could eventually become that way, but we're nowhere near that yet.
Well, yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because I spoke to a kind of leading expert on this, and she was like, yeah, it's as good as the pill. When used in real life, that is. So because the pill is one of those things that in studies, it's super effective in kind of controlled environments. But when it's being used in real life, people forget to take it, or they don't take it exactly the way you're meant to. Or, you know, and there are so many different kinds of pill, and maybe it takes a while to get exactly the right one for you. And plus, they have really gnarly side effects.
So, gnarly is one word, right?
And I think that's the official scientific word.
You mentioned it briefly earlier, that the reason that it was developed was because she was unhappy with some of the side effects of the pill. And this is the crucial part as to why this app might be more successful, is it's a non-chemical way of managing this, which for a lot of people will be very good news.
Well, that's the thing. So I can't take pills because I've got a brain condition. So I actually run the risk of a stroke from having the pill. So that means I have to then get an implant, which is a 3-year commitment. It costs the NHS a lot of money. I don't have that. The alternatives are then to have an injection put in my bum, like every 12 weeks or something, or a coil actually inserted inside me. And so those are the options. So if this app actually worked, out of all of those, I would definitely prefer to use it. It would just need to get to the level where it's a bit more, like, fully approved, tested, all that sort of stuff.
And it's super important that it was developed by a woman.
Yeah. Because we did a story recently, slightly different, but talking about sex technology generally, and huge numbers of these products are actually designed by men, but the products themselves are for women. So to have a woman with all her scientific background, to have that basis, and the fact that she's a woman, and she's solving a problem that she had, means that it's this sort of all-rounded package.
She's also Swedish. I feel like that adds something.
There we go. That's all you need to know. There was a second story this week that I wanted to touch on here because it's really, really relevant. Matt Burgess, you were writing about a male contraceptive which has been trialled in monkeys and has been shown to be really quite effective.
Yeah, so there's a new gel at the moment which is being developed by a company in America and has been tested sort of semi-independently by a research body. There was one person from the company on the study, but they were just affiliated. So it wasn't a case of this is our company, we're doing our own research. It was outsourced to somebody else. And the gel is called Vasagel, and it's been trialled in monkeys. And 16 monkeys, male monkeys, had this gel injected into them. And it basically acts as a barrier and a blockade to stop semen from being ejaculated.
So it's ejected into a specific point near the testes, and it just means that the sperm can't get out. It creates a gel-like block.
Yeah, it's injected into the vas deferens, which is a tube which connects the testes, and basically the polymer inside the gel forms as a hydrogel after injection, which creates a barrier which the sperm can't pass through, but other liquids are able to, or not liquids, but other...
It doesn't cause any problems by blocking what it blocks.
No, exactly. That's correct. It stops sperm from going through, but allows the passage of other needed...
And it's temporary, right? So it eventually gets absorbed into the body and it's non-toxic and all these sort of things.
So the semen, which is actually being blocked through, gets reabsorbed into the body. And during this trial, 16 monkeys were injected over long term. So some of them were injected for more than sort of 2 years. Others were injected for around a year or living with female monkeys. And they didn't have any babies. There was no conceptions at all during this period.
And what's quite interesting about this is that it should be noted as well, one of the monkeys had never successfully conceived with any female, but one of them has had 18 babies. So this monkey is really, really fertile in the same breeding partners that he's been having these 18 babies with, and he didn't conceive at all. And that's what I thought was one of the really interesting things, that it's not just it sort of doesn't work and there are all these caveats. It's one monkey, absolute lad. He couldn't get anyone pregnant.
Absolute lad. And we should say the caveat that a scientific study on animals does not an effective solution for humans maketh. That's kind of a golden rule of research.
That is the next step. That's what they're going to try next. They said there's going to be human trials. This gel has been tried in rabbits as well and been successful.
And everyone knows what rabbits are like.
Exactly, yes.
Massive lads.
Massive lads, yes. And in line with that, we did a poll, which isn't in any way scientific.
No way scientific.
We asked Twitter. What did we ask Twitter?
So I basically just put it out to my Twitter followers. Would you be interested in using this gel? And it was, the answers were yes, inject me. No, I'll pass, thanks. Now, there's no way actually of knowing exactly how much the split, whether it's aimed at... I was aiming at men, but obviously men and women may have voted on there. But 63% of the votes, of 260-something votes, said they would want to be injected. Would you want to be injected?
Matt Burgess, you go first.
I'm going to say yes. Obviously, it would have to be proved to be safe for humans. But I think just contraception is so one-sided in terms of the male to female split when you exclude the condom, that I think that it's, yes, there should be more options for men. So why not?
And I wonder when they eventually develop it, if it will be the sort of thing when they develop it for humans and it actually comes out, if it ever does, if it will be the sort of thing that you could administer at home with, like, just a, like, I don't know, like some little pod applicator thing that you just kind of...
Like an EpiPen almost. Yeah. That sort of
that's
thing.
That's the word
though.
I'm looking for.
That sort
a testy
of thing.
Pen.
A
yes.
testy pen.
Yeah. Roland, would you?
Yeah, for the same reasons.
Yeah, I think it's going to be kind of boring. We're all wearing maroon and we're all going to have the same answer to this question. But to play devil's advocate, why would I want to inject something into my testicles? Why would I want to block my sperm from... This will be an awful lot of people's response. So maybe 63% said yes. The others that didn't would say, no, this is a horrible thing to do. Why would I want to do it?
Well, some of the conversations that I had around it, the responses I got was like, but we'll just use a condom. Or, well, no, women have always done it. That doesn't mean that needs to be the way it carried on, but there is this viewpoint that, and like I listed earlier, all the different ways that these different contraceptions are available for women, the problem comes to it where men might be up for doing this, but women have a choice of which contraception they can use, and men wouldn't. They would have condoms or they would have this. So it's not giving them a huge amount of selection. And I think as a woman, if I was presented with two contraception options and the man was already the person responsible for it, I'd probably feel the same. I'd probably be a bit like, well, you can just carry on because you've got more options and it's better for you than it is for us. But going back to the point you made about human trials, they did try this a separate contraception on a group of men and they had to stop it because some of the men had hormonal changes and they felt depressed and stuff. It's like, yeah, that's what happens when you're on the female pill.
Mm. And this wasn't a gel or something. This was a male pill. So it was a chemical way of making men safe.
Yeah. And they said, oh, we need to stop it because some of the men are feeling suicidal, which is, of course, really serious. But when you read through the reams of side effects on female pills, one of them is that. One of them is that you may feel depressed. You may feel suicidal. But that got passed and this has been shut down immediately. Mm. So I don't know if that's because they're learning from their mistakes and the pills are out there now and they need this solution, but that seemed really twisted to me, the fact that they shut this down because we don't want the men to have to worry about that sort of stuff.
And you do wonder...
I am on my own here, by the way, in a room full of men, so I do realise that doesn't... I don't mean to sound like I'm attacking you, but that is how I feel. It does feel a little bit like, oh, study did it with men, they were like, oh, absolutely not, but it's okay for women, they're fine.
And you do wonder if the pill were developed now as a new technology, as a new treatment, as these male contraceptives are starting to very, very slowly and eventually come through, if they would have allowed the pill.
Yeah, completely. And I think if they started doing almost like for like, there was no contraception up until this point other than condoms, for example, and they had the same side effects in women and men, they wouldn't be pushing this pill through. Now, it should be, they have done a lot of research into the different types of pills. So like you were saying, there's progesterone only. There are different versions you can take to try and counteract some of these side effects. Because I think what happened is they produced the pill. They're like, we've got a solution for contraception. Here you go, women. And it's an independent thing. But taking control of that and being in charge of your own contraception is actually really, I thought that was a milestone in my life of taking that independence. But I think when you get to the point where they go, oh, actually now there are quite some side effects, so we need to do some more work to make sure that, surprisingly, scientists, not all women are the same. And it'll be the same with this as well. I think there were a few complications with this gel that came out. They were very few and far between, but even on there were some complications where I think, in fairness though, they injected one of the monkeys in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And it caused a little bit of an issue. But there is that wider issue that, well, the gel is one way, we've got 10 or whatever it is. Yeah. So that's why it's the way that it is.
So there's the potential that we're very slowly moving towards a future where you maybe as a couple go to your doctor and say, we're in a long-term relationship, we want to not have kids right now, and we both want to make sure that we're having safe sex, don't want to use condoms or whatever it is, what are our options? And they'll go, well, the male partner can use these options and the female partner can use these options. And you can come up with an equitable solution for both of you based on whatever reactions that you have or opinions that you have. And it makes it fair, right? As Matt said earlier, it's so one-sided at the moment. And this offers the potential for it to be just a little bit less one-sided.
And that's the thing as well. It's bringing that balance, so that if you don't want a child with your partner, you can both take it. Because at the moment, there's a lot of trust. The man puts a lot of trust. So if a woman says they're on the pill, you trust them. And most relationships, you don't need to doubt that. But then it goes the other way. I know some women that I spoke to about the male thing, they made it as like quite an off-the-cuff remark. But it is quite serious. They were like, I'm not sure I trust my husband to do that every day. So it's that, well, if you're both doing it and you know that you've got yourself covered, then that doesn't even factor into it anymore. And it's a bit of a shame that it has to come down to that, and those are the sorts of conversations we're having. But if it came to the point where you're both doing it, then those conversations are out the window.
And it remains to be seen if it will be properly effective on humans when they start the trials, and if it will ever come to market, and then what kind of success it will have. But it's a really, really fascinating development, and one that generated an awful lot of debate on this podcast and in the office over the last week. That'll do us for this week, I think. Unless anyone has any more from the Maroon 3? No? More from Vicky?
I feel like you should do a song.
Please no. Yeah, to close the show. That's it. We'll do it. No, we won't. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.